Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Our announcer is out with a cold, so you have me again, but not for long. The first half of today's episode is James Bridger going solo with an interview of Robert Young Pelton, author, journalist, and documentary filmmaker who makes the war correspondence of the likes of Christian Amanpour look like children playing in the sand trap at a country club. Author of World's Most Dangerous Places and founder of the magazine Dangerous, a list of his accomplishments would take up a whole show, so we'll leave it there. Robert Pelton will be leaving shortly on his crowd-funded trip to find Joseph Kony, so our interview starts there and moves on to other developments in the region from piracy to civil wars. The second half of our show will be an interview conducted with me on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM in Washington, D.C., on defense topics to watch in the upcoming year. We'll talk about Africa, China, drones, and innovation in the military. Remember, we are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. Also, recommend us to a friend and ask them to subscribe. We think Sea Control is a fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is planning to steal one sock out of every pair you own. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
I'm James Bridger, filling in for Matt Hipple, and with me today is Robert Young Pelton, author of the prolific World's Most Dangerous Places, and a man whose Rolodex of rebels, warlords, mercenaries, and spooks rivals that of any CIA or MI6 operative. Rob is about to embark on one of his most exciting adventures yet, a crowdsource-funded expedition to track down the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, Joseph Kony. Thank you, Rob.
Hey, nice to meet you, James. On audio.
So, Rob, can you tell me a bit about how this idea came about? This is obviously a prolific rebel leader that has eluded capture from everyone from the U.S. to the Ugandan military for decades. How is your approach different?
Well, first of all, I do this for a living, so it's not unusual for me to go find some elusive or hard-to-find criminal, warlord, rebel leader, jihadi group, or whatever. So I've been doing this since the mid-90s, and it's a fairly repeatable procedure. I was looking for Kony in 1996. I was with the SPLA on the front line south of Juba, and at that time they were mowing down hundreds of Pakistani jihadis sent by the north, and the LRA was really just sort of a minor problem. They attacked buses and villages, but the root cause of what Kony is about is very interesting to me, because he was an Acholi fighting for, I guess, his land and his culture. And Museveni, who was the leader at the time, a southerner, saw the potential in basically pacifying the north of Uganda. So over the years, you know, I've met with and been in combat with many groups, and I just sort of kept Kony tucked away in the back of my mind. And then about last year, I thought, hey, well, you know, this Invisible Children video and all this hoopla about, you know, Kony and this and that really raised people's perception of why is this guy out here. He had an ICC warrant for his arrest. I think it was clear that his group or members of his group were involved in some atrocities, which is not unusual for Africa. But there was a singular focus on this one man who really, you know, his heyday was in the late 90s. When he was actually in Uganda, not on the run. So I thought, well, let's involve everybody in this. Instead of me just finding him and sort of writing about it later, let's get everybody involved and teach people how we do that. So problems aren't so remote and difficult. We can all learn how to do this. So that's essentially the short version of why I'm looking for Kony, but I'm involving the public.
Now, you mentioned the heyday of the LRA in the late 90s. What kind of fighting force is it today? Do you have any information on what you expect their numbers to be or how many combat veterans or child soldiers?
Well, the LRA is an interesting group because it's a multi-generational group of abductees, which means that there's a very small group of senior commanders. Many of them were abducted in the 90s, and they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s. There's about 200 fighters. They're broken into about four subgroups wandering over the eastern region of the Central African Republic. And they're disconnected because they used to use sat phones, they used to get airdrops from Sudan of weapons, and now they're just basically laying low because there's a rather robust U.S.-backed initiative called the Counter-LRA program, in which they have two ISR planes, two beach crafts flying over looking for radio signals. They have about, I want to say 2,000, but I think that's an exaggeration. They have about 1,000 good troops, mostly Ugandan, being trained up to go into the bush, use GPSs, rendezvous. They're using these old battered Hueys to lift these troops into the jungle. And they've had occasional contact with them, but it's really the tail end of the movie, you know. They're looking for bits and pieces of the LRA in Central Africa using troops from four different countries. And these troops are really sort of on the run. They're not in fixed positions like they used to be in Garamba National Park in the north of DRC or in Kafia Kingi in the disputed area in the northwest of South Sudan. So they're basically on the run.
What is it then that has prevented anyone else from actually locating and capturing or killing Joseph Kony in all these years? You know, there was a lot of press that there's 100 U.S. special forces advising and training. You have the militaries from Uganda, South Sudan, CAR, and other states supporting that. So why is it that they haven't been able to actually bring this man in all that time?
Well, here's what's interesting. Kony has been active for over two decades, you know, both as a rebel group and as a terrorist or as a sort of thorn in the side of the stabilization efforts of the regional governments. And you would think, with the amount of military aid that's poured into Uganda, that there would be a fait accompli to simply go get Kony. But Kony's also a tool of Sudan. And you know, there's about three or four proxy groups fighting on behalf of Sudan. So he kind of fades away and comes back. The last time he was actually on tape was 2006 to 2008, when Riek Machar, the vice president of Sudan, or former vice president of Sudan, South Sudan, set up peace talks. So the reason he's eluded capture is because he's kind of like bin Laden. He's a pawn. He's used by different sides for different reasons. And a lot of these programs are tangential. They're not directly going out to find Joseph Kony. For example, the Special Forces program is primarily a FID program. That's a training program that increases the skill sets of indigenous troops, because the SF is not really pulling triggers. You know, it's not like Navy SEALs go out and capture somebody and bring them back. They're training the local troops to do that. And, of course, that's a much, much more complicated, lengthy process than just going out and getting someone.
I see. Now, how is the LRA then sustaining itself in the field, having lost, you know, a lot of the patronage it used to receive from Sudan?
Well, first of all, you have to look at a satellite photo of the region. The people have compared the area that the LRA moves in to the size of Texas, and I would correct them by saying that with trucks and aircraft, the LRA could move in an area the size of the United States. And the central part of Africa is a mix of sort of very high sawgrass, you know, 6 feet to 12 feet high, triple canopy forest, scrub, burnt areas. It's an extraordinarily difficult terrain to move over. And come March, it'll start raining, and that entire area just turns into swamp. So it's almost physically impossible to walk through. And even if you fly an aircraft and you're using, you know, sophisticated infrared, what's the difference between three hunters and three members of the LRA? So the LRA is just simply moving along hunting trails in small groups. Occasionally they'll make contact with a village. They'll steal some supplies, basic supplies. They might kidnap some people to carry it. And that's about it. It's very haphazard, and it's not a large group of people moving like an army would.
I see. Now, you mentioned an area the size of the U.S. now to search. You've indicated in the past that where you expect to find Kony or where you're looking is not exactly where many of the popular perceptions of him being are.
Right.
That's obviously something you're quite tight-lipped about for this project, but can you shed any light about misconceptions about where Kony might be?
Yeah, the first thing is we have this very Darwinian view of bad people. You may remember we thought bin Laden was hiding in a cave and sort of squatting on his haunches. You know, we tend to view these people as stupid and as desperate. People who command large groups of people typically have to have a house, they have to have drivers, communications, messengers, you know. Secondly, they can bushwalk. You know, Kony has no problem taking two bodyguards. You know, I spent a lot of time in the jungles of Burma, in the mountains of Afghanistan with rebel groups, and when things get very tense, they tend to split into very small groups that hunker down in houses. And more importantly, they can get sanctuary. You know, Kony has friends in Europe. He's got friends in Nairobi. He's got friends in Kampala. It's not inconceivable that he could be hosted by a rebel leader who wants to use him as a pawn. So you don't just look for these people under banana leaves hoping that they're cowering in fright.
I see. That actually brings me to my next question here. There's obviously been quite a shake-up security-wise across the region since even this expedition was announced. Do you think the ongoing violence and instability in South Sudan and Central African Republic will allow the LRA to make inroads or cause problems for it?
No, we expected this because of the season. I mean, seasonally you fight wars when you can move around. In Africa, you don't fight wars in the rainy season. So we've got about a two-month window in which if you're going to make your move, you have to make it. So right now, situation in the car is very, very favorable to Joseph Kony and the LRA. The situation in South Sudan is very, very favorable to Joseph Kony. As I said, the former Vice President, Riek Machar, was Kony's best friend and set up those peace talks. And you would think that if somebody's going to reach out and try to restructure the political landscape, it's going to be a combination of Sudan, the newer people, and of course the Acholi people who are related, you know, ethnically and have the same basic root causes. They don't want to be marginalized.
And can you discuss at all the sort of larger geopolitical implications of this breakdown in both South Sudan and Central African Republic as it concerns Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia?
Yeah, well, here's what's fascinating to me. I'm a fan of history, and I go back to the 1860s when they had the scramble for Africa, and then the later, 1880s to 1890s when Leopold was sending Stanley around to sign contracts with local chieftains for a bolt of cloth. And we're seeing very much the same thing going on with the oil resources, with mining. You're sending in people to what is theoretically a stable region to finalize all these development contracts for essentially pennies on the dollar. And the myth is that these contracts and the politicians who sign them are somehow stable enough to be around so you can extract, your profits. So on a much larger scale, with the oil discoveries in Uganda, with the new technologies that allow people to fly over countries and tell you exactly what gold or rare minerals are under your jungles, you have another scramble for Africa. And Uganda is a major player in that. You know, there's a lot of money being pumped into the Ugandan government, which is run by an old rebel who knows how to work the foreign countries. And he's providing a stabilizing platform for these sort of unstable areas like the DRC, CAR, and South Sudan. And the other thing you're going to see is a shift away from the UN as being the go-to agency for stabilization. You know, as you know, they're spending $1.5 billion a year in the Congo to have the UN fight a very active war with, gunships and artillery against rebels. And that's probably going to be replaced by regional stability groups under the AU.
Do you see this then? I mean, again, looking back to history, as you know, we saw the wars in the Congo for almost 20 years that became a free for all of a free for all of competing state interests all trying to take a share. Do you see the same sort of thing now starting to take root in CAR and South Sudan?
Of course, because here's what people forget. This is normal and natural to have warfare in Africa because Whether you're fighting over cattle or land or resources or contracts, somebody comes in, signs a bunch of contracts, makes a small group of kleptocrats wealthy, and the only way that another ethnic group or political party or even neighbor can dislodge that is essentially just overthrowing the entire country, negating all those contracts, and then, you know, getting their place at the trough. So what you saw in South Sudan was, you know, the Dinka trying to minimize the newer presence in that country, and they reacted accordingly. What you're seeing in the CARs is a bunch of regional players, you know, jostling for control. You see the same thing in the DRC. Uganda has a strong man as a leader, and he's used horrific methods to get stability in Uganda. If you look back at the history of Museveni's atrocities against the Acholis in the north, you could almost compare him to Leopold. You know, he took no pains in destroying the lifestyle of the Acholis. And Joseph Kony is almost like a Geronimo. You know, he's sort of the last vestige of that sort of rebellion to retain open land and freedom by these nomadic grazers.
Now, I think back to Kony, a question on a lot of people's minds is, what is it you're actually, if you, you know, find Kony, have his location pinned down, what's your next move from there?
Well, you know, to be honest, James, this is more like springtime for Hitler than an actual bounty hunting activity. I'm using Kony as a through line. I'm going to look for Kony, and I legitimately will find him and talk to him and discuss what he wants to do. But along the way, I want to ask a lot of embarrassing questions, and I want to understand a lot of things that I don't understand. So I'm essentially using this sort of almost mythical figure, you know, this mysticist, this sort of, the only sort of jihadi Christian leader, as a storyline, you know. And I don't want to use the Heart of Darkness thing because it's actually the reverse of that. I'm hoping to get to some light and knowledge. But I think by following Kony's trail and talking to his friends and talking to his enemies, I'm going to come up with a very interesting book and a very interesting story.
There is a book expected out of this then.
Yeah, St. Martin's has signed the book deal. They're very excited because they know this new focus on Africa is missing a very singular element, and that is the African voice. One of the things that I brought up over and over again was when you read the history of Africa, you very rarely hear an African tell the history of Africa. And what we're seeing today is something very similar, where as Westerners we're subjected to this bizarre sort of Save Africa meme that's overlaid on every business opportunity, every cell phone, every musical concert. And, you know, to get people riled up, I'll show them a generic picture of starving African kids, and I'll say, where is that? And they have no idea. They don't even realize that charities are using generic photos of kids from the 60s, typically in Biafra, because it's a very popular thing to be concerned about Africa.
I know you've had I was a big fan of the project you used to run in Somalia, the Somalia Report, that was, you know, essentially creating this network of local journalists to actually get the real answers to the headlines, you know, piracy, Al-Shabaab's militancy, but, you know, getting the details and the real element of what was going on. Is that something, too, that you're going to, you see that model being used in Central Africa for you?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, and people in their own country are allowed to both succeed and fail any way they want. And one of the things I loved about setting up ground networks in Somalia and Iraq and Afghanistan is we want to see things through a Western narrative, a very Teutonic, almost European structure. And we get upset when things don't make sense. So by talking to locals, for example, the whole issue of piracy, which I viewed as a very good scam between the UK insurance companies, ship owners, and pirates, was portrayed as by Somalis as sort of defending the ocean and protecting it from toxic dumping. Well, we used Somalis to destroy that myth. You know, we proved that Somalis are strip mining the ocean themselves just fine, and that there is no toxic dumping, and that piracy is really more a function of British insurance companies willing to pay millions of dollars to complete strangers because they have insurance. In Central Africa, I want to set up the same type of network. We won't have 24/7 reporting, but the same type of network of intelligent, sort of prodding local men and women who don't accept the traditional, you know, through lines or story structures, and really start looking into why we approach Africa as a singular country and why we approach Africa as a, I don't know, almost 18th century cripple or somebody that needs our help all the time. So, and there's faults, you know, we'll expose the faults. But my first goal is to get people focused, you know, why should we focus on Africa? Because that is the last place on earth where we can rapidly increase sort of the quality of life, but at what cost? So that to me is a great challenge to understand a lot of that. I'm focusing on Central Africa, which is probably the most remote and least developed and about to be the most developed part of the world.
It's certainly least understood too, even in, you know, the headlines that come out now between Nigeria, Mali, Somalia, you know, yeah. The whole web of interconnected conflicts in between. Can you shed some more light on sort of the questions you want to ask and some of the embarrassments you're hoping to expose over the course of this?
Well, we're going to start with Big Ag. You know, Big Ag is the idea that Western companies can go to remote places that have rainfall, good earth, give somebody a blanket and then get a deed to their property and then start growing avocados to send to Dubai to fancy five-star hotels. We're going to dig into the oil because that's going to dramatically change the whole Rift Valley. There's an extraordinary amount of oil reserves that have been discovered there. We're going to deal with the rainforest, you know, that horrible Western thing that you're not supposed to cut down, and kind of point out that, well, they actually did kind of cut it down, and there's not much there. We'll deal with poaching. You know, how does poaching exist? It may not be the poachers you need to worry about. It might actually be the government that you need to put in jail. We're going to talk about theft and exploitation of minerals, of natural resources that can be wrested from, you know, poorly developed governments for pennies on the dollar and don't actually return any benefits to the people who live there. And just generally mix it up. And then, of course, we'll focus on corruption. We'll focus on violence, ethnic division, just all the things that need to be rebooted.
Where, you know, this whole approach you've taken to it, you had the, I can't remember the name, it was sort of a Kickstarter-esque system of funding.
Yeah.
But that was then supplemented, I believe, by some sort of private donations. Or do you have any big media backing for this venture?
I tried, well, here's the thing, the reason for Kickstarter is I wanted a lot of little donations, $5, $10, $15, to get people sort of hooked up as subscribers, if you will. And then I wanted those people to help me. As I traveled through Africa, I would pose questions to them, and they would do the research, and they would, you know, send me information. The bulk of what I'm doing is funded, as everything I do, by myself. Now, I will be doing some stories for Vice. Vice has a magazine. They also have a news service. I will be writing this book for St. Martin's, which will take about a year. And I also have Dangerous Magazine, dangerousmagazine.com, which I file stories when I feel like it. But I really don't want a big media company behind me. I don't want a government behind me. I don't want any sort of taskmaster who shapes or prods my discovery.
And what type of, or sorry, size and type of group are you going in with?
Well, to start with, we're going in with two people, and it's going to be myself and a fellow named Tim Frescia, who's a very well-known photographer and filmmaker who's worked in Africa for, I think, over two decades. And then in about a month to 6 weeks, we'll ramp that up to be more of a TV-esque kind of team. And what we're hoping to do is get a group of ex-special operations and very interesting people with very interesting backstories so that we could actually build these groundwork networks, do medical visits to these towns, and get out in the bush and start showing how you find somebody in something that size, you know, be it Texas or the United States. And more importantly, have experts on the ground that can look at things and interpret them in new ways. So whether that person is an anthropologist or a biologist or a professional tracker or an intel person, we're just bringing new brains and new ideas and new approaches to this hunt.
I see. And not that it would ever dissuade you from going anywhere, but what sort of resistance have you received to, you know, going in and doing things this way, in such an unorthodox fashion?
Well, James, I don't ever do anything to make anybody happy, so you can imagine that a lot of people have sort of blinked twice and just ran screaming in the opposite direction, among them being Invisible Children, the largest single charity that focuses on Coney, is terrified to talk to me. And I think terrified in a way that's good, because it's almost like the emperor no longer wears clothes, because something like a $60 million a year charity has to come up with gimmicks like people throwing up in buckets instead of just going to Africa and dealing with this. So I think we'll start with the largest, I guess, most visible creators of the focus on Coney, and then we'll go down to the government. Now, strangely enough, there are people in the government who really like what I'm doing. They really, truly have a passion for figuring this thing out. And I was very, very pleased to meet some of the people involved in the counter-LRA program. But of course, there's people who think that I'm nuts. It's like, why would you do this? What is the purpose? And I keep thinking, well, if there's evil on Earth, let's go meet it. You know, which is what I've done all my life. Whether it's, you know, jihadi groups or rebel groups or terrorist groups, I just go meet them and I live with them and I talk to them and I ask them questions, and people suddenly walk away with a very different view of why people get involved in conflict to resolve their problems.
Well, it should be I'm very excited to see the results of this, and I think it, you know, you're right that it does open up a whole new spectrum of changing the way we think about reporting and investigative journalism and, you know, even foreign aid and investment. If I can shift gears a little bit.
Yeah, let me add one thing. If you can imagine in the 1800s, if a mustachioed man like myself said, you know, I'm going to go find Geronimo and I'm going to ask him what he thinks about all these people trying to hunt him down, I almost sense the same feeling of meeting Coney and talking to him about what he thinks is going on.
Are you expecting to be able to get an interview with him?
Yeah, of course. That's what I do.
When was the, do you know, has he been interviewed any time in the last 2 decades?
No.
When was the last time he spoke to the press?
2008, and then the two people that talked to him, you know, I talked to them. So I talked to Coney's friends. I have a fairly comfortable feeling of how to get in touch with him.
Well, you've certainly demonstrated that in the past. Recall your question in Papua New Guinea to Francis Ankra, is that the name?
Francis Ona, yeah. Well, yeah. Francis Ona in Bougainville was a guy that swore to kill any white man that stepped on his island. You remember in Somalia, I tracked, at the peak, over 400 hostages and where they were and their health. I've tracked bin Laden in 2003 and found the location of Zawahiri and bin Laden, published it in National Geographic. So it's honestly, it's really not that big a deal to go find leaders of rebel groups. It's just that people tend to be a little bit timid about doing it without a gun, you know, alone in the bush. So,
Najeed, wouldn't be your first time. There was an assassination attempt in Uganda on you.
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the groups I want to meet with, which is the ADF. It's an Islamic group that used to be aligned with Idi Amin. And they put one of those pressure cooker bombs under my table at the Speaks Hotel. And actually, they let off two bombs that night. And for some unknown reason, I decided to go up and figure out what the hell was in my room. And the bomb went off. And I spent the night picking up pieces of Ugandans.
Well, we'll have to hope for a safer, certainly not uneventful trip this time.
Mm.
If I can shift gears, this being a maritime security think tank, slightly east over to Somalia, we've recently had an election in Puntland, the heartland of Somali piracy, and had something of a surprising result with the incumbent President Farrolli, who had set up the Puntland Maritime Police Force and played a role in, suppressing almost, he would claim, eliminating piracy from Puntland. Where do you see this going? Is Somali piracy finished? Is there a second round in the hat once the navies leave?
Well, I think you know the history very well, but piracy was actually a very minor blip from about 2008 to, let's say, 2010, 2011. And it was brought along by the fact that you could go out in a skiff, climb aboard an unarmed ship, tell the captain that you're in charge, and park it outside of Habyo and wait, you know, 3, 6, 8 months until somebody dropped $3 million to $12 million in your lap. And nobody would come and get you. I mean, nobody would attack you. Nobody would try to shoot you or whatever. So it was a very comfortable business model that was interrupted by the creation of the maritime security industry, which we have always said is the single most effective way to keep a pirate from jumping aboard your ship is to shoot a bullet through his Yamaha engine and ask him if he knows how to swim. So that simple binary decision essentially stopped piracy in its track. Now, there are still pirates, and I would disagree that Puntland was the home of piracy because it tended to be more in the central area of the region. You know, Eel was a pirate capital, but really it flourished in the central part, and it didn't take off in the south at all. So it's a very sort of tiny opportunistic window. Now, if, let's say, they take armed guards off of ships because it's quite expensive, and they come up with, I don't know, more electric fences or whatever, piracy will come back in a heartbeat because Somalis are extraordinarily smart about figuring out how to do these type of things. But if they stop making insurance payments, they wouldn't grab ships anymore. So there's a lot of cause and effects that were never really dealt with. I wouldn't necessarily credit the huge multi-billion dollar, you know, government efforts in eliminating piracy. It sounded good, it looked good, but, you know, somehow people would donate money to fight piracy and they'd end up building a road in Mozambique, and I'm like, that's interesting. So there was a lot of noise and light, but the bottom line is, A, you cut off their home bases, and B, you put guns on ships and there's no more pirates.
What about switching coasts here, piracy in the Gulf of Guinea?
Well, that's, once again, Mende and those people are much more professional than Somali pirates, and it's a very different business model. You know, bunkering or the theft of fuel for sale on bunker ships has been around for decades. It's not new, but these pirates are so audacious and so violent that people don't really want to interdict them. They want to sit this thing out and try to go find their ship once it's been stripped of the oil. A lot of things have to be thought through. For example, the militarization of commercial ships might be an option there. In other words, armed bunker ships. The things that they want are harder to get. It is typically a major deterrent when you pull up on a ship and there's a GE minigun pointing at you as opposed to like a single-shot rifle. So they're just going to have to ramp up their security measures.
I see.
Which is not a very popular idea for sailors who, you know, if you know sailors, the last thing they want to be is Rambos, and they're even quite nervous having security people on board the ship because they know the pirates will shoot back.
And a very different story, too, in the waters of Nigeria than Somalia in terms of the legality of armed guards there.
Yeah, and like I said, the issue with piracy is that nobody wanted to do anything. You know, we ask, why do these things exist? If you simply had a rapid response team in that region that guaranteed 100% went in and rescued every ship, there would be no pirates. They are scared to death of violent interaction, like that one time the PMPF went off after the oil tanker, the Sirius, and it turned out to be the thing that really shifted the balance there, that they couldn't hide on land anymore. In Nigeria, there is simply no access to where these people hide, and there is no sort of violent response when these ships are hijacked.
A fair deal of, I mean, collusion and patronage of pirate and oil theft gangs, too, and both the Nigerian military and political and economic elite as well.
Well, I'll give you an example. I sailed on a ship from Dubai to Somalia just so I could experience, you know, a pirate cruise. And I had this little captain from Myanmar who told me all these stories. And one of the things that people don't really realize is that there's a huge black market. A lot of these hijackings and oil theft and oil sales are how captains line their pockets. You know, this captain would explain that, you know, he burned X number of tons of fuel per day in his ship, and he could sell that. If he went to Nigeria, people would come next to him and suck out his oil, and then he'd go in and buy some more, and they'd suck it out again. So there is a thriving black market in bunker oil.
Yeah, it's quite commonly come up that even a lot of what we would call piracy and incidents from, you know, the Gulf of Guinea down to Southeast Asia are really just insider deals.
Exactly.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you very much, Rob. This has been a most insightful conversation. Is there any plug you've got for how our listeners can follow and support your efforts to go after Coney?
Yeah, we have a website called Expedition Coney. And if you want to set up a Google alert, you know, just type my name in there. I usually show up on some news program or interview. You know, we have a genuine attempt to share what we're doing. I'm not hiding, you know, there's been a lot of PR on this. And I really want to teach people how you get to the heart of these things. And if we succeed, that's great. If we fail, that's great. We're just doing it.
Well, if anything else, it's certainly showing that there is a different way to go about all these things, which really haven't amounted to a great number of success stories. The very fact that he has been running around for two decades without, you know, the combined might of every regional government and foreign support they receive, and there you are going to go and do it yourself. So best of luck. When is it you're setting out?
24th.
All right. Well, best of luck from myself and everyone here at SimSec. Thank you for your time, Rob.
Thanks, and James.
We hope you get him.
Okay.
The interview at the very least.
Exactly. Cheers. Or a signed t-shirt. Love that.
Now, how about that? That is one hell of an interview. Now, we'll finish today's show with something a little bit more tame. The interview conducted on Federal News Radio with me on defense issues to watch in the coming year. We'll be talking about Africa, China, drones, and military innovation.
The Navy will have to focus on new strategic boundaries in 2014. The drawdowns in the Middle East region will let the department focus on other global hotspots. Matt Hippel is director of the Next War blog at the Center for International Maritime Security. As part of our Top 3 for 14 series, he says one of those new priorities will be a focus on African instability.
When I'm looking at African instability, I'm looking at three major factors that make this important, because the first question is why is it important? And the three factors are the human tragedy, global energy markets, and terrorism. Human tragedy, naturally, because when it comes to instability and conflict, there's refugees, there's innocent death, victims and death, which is the primary point, of course, as a human being. But when it comes to global energy markets and terrorism, states like Sudan, states like Nigeria, major oil producers, and even though the United States and Canada produce most of the oil consumed here in North America, effect on other energy-rich states will have a massive effect on global energy markets in a world economy that's still trying to recover. And for terrorism, we think about the power vacuum that happened in Afghanistan. Afghanistan could roughly fit into Tanzania in Africa, just for a general thought on size. Major countries that are in having conflicts that we're noting now are the Central African Republic, Mali, South Sudan, Nigeria, and then conflict from Mali and Nigeria spreading to Cameroon, as well as Niger. You've still got Somalia. You've still got conflict north of the Sahara. It's pretty incredible swath of instability that's covering an area of land roughly the size of the United States. Now, as for how this is important to the Navy in particular, the Navy and the Coast Guard do engage in a lot of security cooperation in coastal states, especially when it comes to Somalia and Nigeria. Nigeria has a huge problem with corruption, which is leading to a problem with piracy. Now, the corruption can't be solved by military engagements and training, but you can at least help those who are not corrupt engage in eliminating these causes of weakness, because corruption in the government spreads to weakening that government's ability to react to larger problems. And it'll also be important largely because, and I'll admit this, and again, just as a preface, I do not speak for the Department of the Navy or the United States government in this capacity, just myself, is that this is a big Army job, Army and Marine Corps. So for the United States Navy, when it comes to its strategic considerations, when it comes to fighting for the budget, the Africa equation is not going to be their strongest argument, but it's going to be a very big argument coming here into the future. So in that way, in an organizational way, it will be important to the Navy. But generally speaking, those would be the factors that on my mind are what made me put it number one on that list.
Now, what would that African involvement look like logistically? I mean, we already have 100 troops looking for Joseph Kony, the rebel commander that's going around and terrorizing Central Africa. He's not a terrorist, but he falls more under that human tragedy component that you first mentioned. Is that the type of involvement that you see the Navy pursuing, where it's regional and specific according to a very closely defined mission? Or is it more like what we see in Europe, where there's a permanent base and troop presence that can quickly deploy to areas around the continent and around the world?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. The way of our involvement with Africa is evolving, is changing. You know, you have a conventional view. Are we going to send troops there? Are we going to have a base? Well, what's just happened? The Central African Republic's fallen into a state of rebellion. Have the Seleka rebels versus the anti-Balaka. If anti-Balaka means the anti-machete league, if you will, which, as you can imagine, is an allusion to the Rwandan genocide. And the United States has just pumped $100 million into the Central African Republic to support African Union troops and their transport into the country. So it's a soft power effort in support of a hard power effort. They just sent Ambassador Samantha Powers down there as well. She's the ambassador to the UN. There's also the ability to arrange more friendly legal environment for countries to be able to fight these rebels. For example, when you talk about Joseph Kony, there was an arrangement made that allowed troops from other countries to pursue Joseph Kony at will across borders. So when you look at Nigeria right now having a problem with Boko Haram, they're not able to pursue Boko Haram into neighboring countries, which becomes a problem if they have these free open areas. Again, the reference to Afghanistan, if a country has a power vacuum and then a group has the ability to operate at will on the other side of that border, it becomes a problem. Well, with Boko Haram, if you were able to use soft power to open up those borders or to get these countries more heavily involved into defeating the Boko Haram threat, then you would solve a lot more problems than necessarily the use of American troops. Now, in Uganda, we do have several hundred troops on the ground training folks, which is also important, professionalism and capacity. But as we've seen in Somalia, as we've seen in the Sudan, the African Union, ECOWAS, other regional players, African solutions to African problems is kind of the phrase, and it's a good phrase. It is the way to create sustainable answers to Africa's security problems. But if you let the problem spiral out of control as it is now, as I said before, it's roughly a swath of instability is from the east to west American coasts, if you could imagine such a thing. That's what's happening right now. So we're changing the way we're involved, but especially in this case, Nigeria is typically the country that provides these peacekeepers and troops for the support of peace and stability when it comes to these peacekeeping missions. Well, right now they're facing a massive rebellion in the north. So the Nigerian troops that are usually sent out to, for example, the major conflict in Sierra Leone was largely supported by Nigerian peacekeepers. Those peacekeepers aren't there anymore. They've been all pulled back to Nigeria to fight this massive rebellion in the north. And folks may not realize this, but they've heard about Boko Haram in the news. They know it's a terrorist organization. Recently, they've attacked the Maiduguri airport, which is also a military airbase in the north. Several hundred rebels just broke into a military base and started burning trucks and airplanes. This is a conventional military assault. This is a change in the game and an escalation in a conflict that the government hoped that they were winning. So things are getting worse and not better.
So when the Navy looks at Africa, it sounds like that they might have to be preparing for a situation that they're not used to facing. It's sort of an uncharted territory in terms of diplomatic, economic, and military strategy. Now for your second point, we're actually going to pivot into another region around the world, and that's the China-Pacific region. The Navy's already being very vocal about having an increased role in that area, so why do you put that as number two?
The reason that I put the escalation with China in the Pacific is number two and not number one is exactly the point that you made, is we're talking about uncharted territory, things that are unpredictable when it comes to Africa and the impact on those three factors, the human aspect, the economic aspect, and the power vacuums that support potential global terrorism. When it comes to escalation with China, it's more predictable. We see it running along the model of the 1993 territory grab by Iran, in which it claimed huge excessive swaths of maritime zones in the Gulf. And we also have a better, relatively speaking, relationship with China. We have more lines of communication with an organization that, to a point, we understand and we can predict. And these are normal lines of escalation. So in that much, while the strategic importance of the Pacific and our engagement with China is more important, it is easier to understand. We've had the 1996 Taiwan Strait crisis. We had the P3 incident in 2001. So we've been to this rodeo before. We've engaged in these kinds of escalatory dances. We know the steps of the dance, but we don't know where it's going to go. So that does make it safer. And there's also the impact of having two players where, unlike, let's say, a group of Seleka rebels or any of these rebel ethnic or religious groups in Africa that are in large part pushed by rage, Chinese have very specific strategic interests, and they're going to pursue them in a very tactical way. So that's something that we can count on. Now, for the Navy, why this is important, obviously, I mean, it's the Pacific. It goes without saying. It's a Navy ball field out there. And China's big tool, as it were, or vessel by which it's imposing its new sovereign authority over the East China Sea, which is essentially what it is, the Air Defense Identification Zone. If you read the regulations, word by word, that they've put down, it is largely an imposition of sovereign authority over this region in the air. And my personal opinion, what I think is happening is that they are using their aircraft carrier, the Liaoyang, as a bridge, as it were. So you send the aircraft carrier, say, hey, aircraft carrier is pushing our ADIZ. They're the ones enforcing it. Well, now that my aircraft carrier is there, well, I need to protect that. I'm sure you've heard of the event with the USS Cowpens and the amphibious tank landing craft that the Chinese sent out in front of it, claiming it was interfering with their operations. Well, what they consider their inner defense zone, quote-unquote, this is their words, is roughly a radius of 30 nautical miles around their aircraft carrier. So if you can imagine, that's them saying that no vessels should come into an area of their carrier that's roughly the distance of downtown Washington, D.C. to downtown Baltimore. which is insane. Anyone who's a professional mariner, anyone who's been at sea, anyone in the United States Navy has been out there and has come within 2, 1, or even less a few hundred yards of other vessels. There's no such thing as a 30 nautical mile exclusion zone. It's, again, we're talking about freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas. That's just not something that you can impose in international waters except in the most dangerous of events of wartime and convoy operations and what have you. So I think what we're seeing is them using the aircraft carrier as a bridge down from their air defense identification zone to imposing their authority at the sea.
Now, your third point I found very interesting because it's something I haven't seen on any other list so far for our top 3 for 14 series. And also just to remind people, you did 4 instead of 3, so you actually did a little extra work. But it revolves specifically around drones and developing drone technology. So why did you choose that as your number 3?
Going into 2014, I don't see, when it comes to defense procurement, much change in drones. Now, that's not necessarily the most important part. It's going to be a long haul integrating drones into the Navy. One of the biggest problems that come up with drones is their autonomy. They're still remote systems. They're great in irregular conflicts. However, if you want to fight a conventional conflict against a near or peer opponent, you can't have a system that is designed to rely on remote systems because those remote systems can be denied or hijacked. So it's going to be a long haul for autonomy. There's a lot of really interesting developments, and those are the ones with drones that are the most interesting. Maybe you've seen Google recently bought Boston Dynamics, which is a defense consultancy, not defense consultancy, they're an engineering firm that builds robots, the Mule, one of the land robots for ground forces. These are all really fascinating developments, especially with a company that has their deep logics or deep analytics software that recognizes the basic aspects of certain images and objects. Thanks to the number of cats on the internet, you know, it's probably recognizes the basic aspects of a cat. You've also got guys like Professor Warwick out at the University of Reading in England, where they've actually managed to take the brain cells, the cultured brain cells of a rat, and use them as processors for a small robot. So all these things are very juvenile technologies, little baby technologies, but so many of them have a great level of potential when it comes to drones. So the thing to watch is the technologies out there that will allow something like the X-47 Bravo that, okay, you can take off and land, you can take off and land on an aircraft carrier, but what are you going to do while you're in the air? I can't dedicate 30 operators on my ship to operating these drones, especially in a denied environment. So what am I going to do next? And it's those technologies that are going to allow drones to operate more autonomously that'll let them conduct these missions. And two is to see if these drones especially break out of their conventional mindset. If you look at the helicopters, the drone helicopters, is the whole series look like a small march towards having a unmanned version of the Kiowa Army's Kiowa Warrior, one of their ISR platforms. But what they're more appropriate for, since they're unmanned and they don't have human beings in them, is something like countermeasures. And I'm writing an article on that right now about how drones would be better used in that way, because one of the big threats today is there's an offensive advantage, especially when it comes to the ocean. We look at A2D, anti-access, area denial, lots of missiles. Essentially, it's rate of fire and range that becomes the greatest threat when you have all these brand-new ASCMs, anti-ship cruise missiles, that have all these different capabilities, is that rather than trying to shoot these down, the best option for the Navy is in the interim before drones do become truly autonomous or you're able to build these systems is try to use them as countermeasure systems so that instead of having to shoot down these missiles, you just confuse them and have them fly away. But that's just this fella's opinion.
Now, drones aside, you're also looking at overall Navy innovation as your fourth topic. What are you seeing on the horizon there for 2014?
Navy innovation, there's some conventional projects to push innovation in the Navy. Navy Warfare Development Center has, or I'm sorry, Navy Warfare Development Command has the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, which is a formal and informal group of officers and enlisted who are all dedicated to the cause of innovation. And they get together, they solve problems, they push it down to the fleet, they let their guys in the deck plates know that the Navy is looking for their ideas, their solution. There's a great email chain that when someone has a problem out there in the fleet, they shop it out to the rest of us in the group, because there's the CRIC, CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, and CRIC-X, as you can imagine, the TED and TEDx model, where there's a larger informal group. So it's really interesting, these formal efforts. They've led to some great projects like the additive manufacturing project, which is now on the USS Essex. So what the Essex is planning to do is, according to some folks I've talked to, is planning to use a 3D printer to build medical equipment in their med bay, which not only has a lot of interesting possibilities for manufacturing of other tools and objects on ships, but also for ground forces. In Afghanistan, the Army had some great success with 3D printers, using them to build small clips and such that on their gear that had broken, so they would send these Connex boxes, or container boxes, shortened ones, out into the field to build this gear so they wouldn't have to send back for them. So if the Navy is able to harness that technology, that would be great. But the informal models are what's most important. Now, back in the 60s, Admiral Zumwalt was a big proponent of junior officer and junior enlisted innovation and leadership. But he existed in a time where it wasn't necessarily natural. He existed in more of a command structure, which we still have today and is good and necessary in a military structure, but there was nothing parallel in civilian society where you look at Facebook, you look at Kickstarter, you look at the TED Talks and TEDx Talks that had this sort of similar crowdsourcing aspect to it. So a lot of his ideas when it came to empowering junior personnel weren't taken up. Folks were kind of afraid of those ideas.
Well, I just like the way you describe it in your writing. You say military innovation will hopefully lose its stigma as an oxymoron.
Ah, yes. It's perfect. I was going to get to that. Yes, folks call military innovation an oxymoron, maybe to a point in the institution itself that may be true, because, as I said, part of the command structure, necessary command structure of a military, isn't as necessarily flexible as we'd like it to be. But the informal networks are what's important. Now, back during the height of Afghanistan and Iraq, military blogging became a big part of our culture. Folks bringing back stories from Iraq and Afghanistan, their experiences, what they saw. And as part of that, folks started to talk about tactics, operations, and strategy. They started to ask, hey, well, how can I do this better? What are the things that are working? What am I observing? What ideas am I coming up with? And they started fleshing it out to the community, socializing these ideas to folks out there. Now, as these conflicts wind down and we have more potential energy in China and Africa and these other locations than we have active energy in the wars that we are conducting, that remains. Officers and enlisted are still out there, they're still blogging, they're still writing articles. United States Naval Institute's a great example that's always been there, where folks have put their ideas out onto page. The Defense Entrepreneurs Forum in Chicago back in October was a great opportunity to talk about technical and organizational innovation. A few hundred folks showed up at the University of Chicago with their own dime, flew from all around the country just to talk about innovation in the military. And myself, I'm involved in the Center for International Maritime Security, CIMSEC. We've got a website, CIMSEC.org, where we talk about technical innovation, foreign policy, and maritime security. So back in the day, there was not this huge informal community of folks organizing on their own, talking about all these concepts. And one, you know, you'd say 2 to 3 generations of leadership from now, the ones who are going to be in charge are the ones who have been connected into and brought up in this environment where, to use another example, Boyd and beyond. Colonel Boyd was a huge innovator, huge influencer in the in decision-making studies in the Air Force. And he has a conference, and J. Scott Shipman ran a conference recently, and it was Air Force guys, Army guys, me, some other Navy guys, all getting together, sitting at the same table, and they talk about competition between the services. And that's true. We each come to the table thinking that we're probably the most important. I won't lie. I think the Navy is the most important, but at the end of the day, you have a greater appreciation for the capabilities of the guys on the other side of the table. And you also understand what they're thinking, and what they're thinking can sometimes open up new doors. Like I said, you probably, if you talk to 10, 20 years ago to somebody in the Navy, they wouldn't be willing necessarily to cede the concept of African security or even a major region to say, hey, this is probably an Army or even necessarily a Marines issue. I want to make this about the fleet. You see a lot more of that today on the informal networks. So it's really interesting. If you'd like to hear more kind of that junior analysis, at SimSec we also have a podcast called Sea Control that's really interesting. And every week I have academics, kind of junior guys, not big names with entrenched concepts or anything like that, just new guys coming up with their own opinions, studying their own ideas. Junior officers, we had a Coast Guard guy from a mobile training team. We talked about Africa. And he talks about what the Coast Guard's doing out there in Africa, Singapore, all over the world, and which is another interesting aspect. You learn about the massive impact the Coast Guard is having, bang for your buck, and it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. When it comes to the services, they're probably the ones that are able to scrounge the most capability out of the money that they're given. I'm sure the Marine Corps would argue about that, but today I'd say the Coast Guards are the winner of that equation. But it's an incredible world out there. There's so much more information. There's so much more discussion, and it's all self-organizing. So when it comes to military innovation, you're not going to see any huge tectonic shifts in 2014, but it's interesting to watch. It's really educational to engage with these people. And over the long haul, you're going to see some great changes as these guys become leadership.
Well, that's it for our show today. I hope everybody really enjoyed the product we were able to put forward. Before I let you get out of here, of course, it's your option. You can leave if you want to, so I can't stop you. But I just ask you to consider going on to iTunes or Stitcher Stream Radio, subscribing to our podcast, leaving a comment, 5 stars, and remember, tell a friend.